Diverse authorities have speculated. Why is it that the common mass of people so adore the rotten, the awful, the trite? In a remote laboratory, two genuine warlocks, Ben R. Williams and Greg Morrison, will look popular taste dead in the eye and hold a scalpel to its bloated gullet. They will read America's most popular books. They will ridicule the New York Times bestseller list. They will destroy their reputations and follow a terrible book even into a rotting grave. This, good people, is cannon fodder.
I'm not a man. I'm a destroyer. I'm not a man. I'm a destroyer.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Ben R. Williams.
And I'm Greg Morrison.
And welcome to episode 16 of Cannon Fodder.
Welcome.
Tonight we'll be discussing The Bridges of Madison County by Robert James Waller, which a book that we both read in its entirety.
Yeah, yeah.
We're back.
Both in a single day, I think.
I think so. But before we get into that, Greg, what you been reading lately?
I will be returning to education, so I've had to do a lot of reading in preparation for that. I would say that a couple things kind of stood out recently as being books of note. Outstealing Horses by Per Pedersen. Mm-hmm. He's Norwegian. It's a really good book. It was one of those, like, you know, books that readers read that don't even like reading. And that always makes me suspicious. But it's actually pretty good. And I really want to read some of his other stuff. And actually, I've kind of gotten into some Annie Dillard lately, which surprised me. But I read her novel, The May Trees, and it sort of pushed me in that direction. I'm not very keen on The May Trees, but I think that I'd like to read some of her nonfiction. But what about you?
Yeah, I've been reading just lately Going Clear, which I cannot remember the name of the author. unfortunately, I just realized, but it's the recent big expose on Scientology.
Oh, okay.
And I'm reading it partly entertainment, partly for research, for a project. I'm going to become a cult leader.
You're going to quit that cult finally, right?
Well, you know, I'll finally go clear and become an operating Thetan on level 3 with just another $250,000. So,
well, really. Do they talk about, like, the terminology and everything? Does he pull back the veil on...
Yes, he does. I'm not too far into it yet, but just downloaded it the other day.
Cool.
But he does go into a lot of that and a lot of L. Ron Hubbard's hucksterism. And right now I'm still mainly in the section about the early days of L. Ron Hubbard when he was ripping people off and being a lunatic. It's extremely interesting.
Cool.
Extremely interesting.
Cool.
I highly recommend it so far.
So, I guess going into this, what did you know about this book, Ben?
You know, the only thing I knew about this book, number one, that it was mercifully short.
Yeah.
And number two, I had a dim recollection of the Clint Eastwood movie that came out in the, I guess, early to mid-90s. And which, of course, caused me, as I was reading the book, to only be able to envision the protagonist as... Clint Eastwood, which may have improved the experience.
Yeah.
I don't like Clint Eastwood. But I guess this was one of his, you know, him doing Bridges of Madison County, that was one of his paint-your-wagon-style role choices. I don't know quite what he was thinking.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
He's sort of bad about that from time to time. But, hectoring empty chairs and all that. But, I didn't know a whole lot beyond that. Love story, I knew that.
Right, right.
What'd you know about it going in?
There was that rash of movies in the mid-90s, like The Prince of Tides, and like all these other movies that I didn't really get because I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And they were all, you know, like older people struggling with demons and falling in love. And all I remember is like a shot of a car going over a bridge, Meryl Streep in a tub. And Clint Eastwood. I wanted to say Lionel Richie for some reason. And Lionel Richie inexplicably was there. Yeah. As Clint Eastwood's black friend.
Yeah, we all remember that.
It was sort of weird, Unforgiven, you know? Yeah. Yeah, you know, I did encounter it in another way. I just realized this. When I was in college, I worked at the Writing Center, so we helped edit papers and stuff like that. And everybody had to take like a special topic seminar as a freshman. And one thing that they really liked to give to the athletes for some reason, I guess just to ridicule them, was a seminar on romance novels. Hmm. And this was one of the books. And since the book is actually kind of confusingly structured and it's just weird, doesn't really make a lot of sense, there were always these athletes like trying to explain it to me, like, no, what happens first is. And I mean, I never really caught on. It never made me any more interested than I already was, which is to say, not at all.
Yeah. Well, I guess, yeah, we can parlay that into the discussion of the book itself.
Yeah.
Reading it, that was maybe the first thing that really surprised me, was that I was expecting a very conventional structure. Mm. And it does not have that.
No.
It has an incredibly strange structure. And so I guess to start with, it opens with an invocation of the muses, sort of, where Robert James Waller, the author, as himself, comes out and says, "All right, look, guys, this is based on a true story.
Yeah.
I did a lot of research on this. I traveled many places to make sure this was accurate." And the point of it seems to be, so if while you're reading it you think it's really mawkish and maudlin, well, that's just because that's how life is sometimes.
Yeah.
So the entire premise that it is a true story, which it is very obviously not, is basically a dodge so that you won't think it's a poorly written romance novel. got bad news, Waller. I got bad news. Don't work.
And that yeah, I mean, so like he addresses the audience directly as the author, and he actually names various characters and says that he's spoken to them. Mm-hmm. And not just like the central characters, but you know, the ancillary characters. Mm-hmm. Then there's the actual novel, quote unquote, like the story. Then there's manuscript pages that one of the characters is supposed to have written, which is a whole nother thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's an interview that the author, the original author, Robert James Waller, claims to have conducted with a wise old black man. And said wise old black man says a lot of, you know, sort of street wisdom things about, like, being a jazz musician and improvising. And he doesn't ever have a G on the end of any word he says.
Just like, you know... suspiciously similar to a wise old black man who appeared in another novel, The Notebook, which is almost just totally ripped off from this book.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
It's extremely similar.
Yeah.
Extremely similar.
Well, that was something that I sort of was puzzling over was, yeah, there are so many things that were so similar. It was like, man, like how did Nicholas Sparks get away with it?
Yeah.
I mean, it is exactly the same. So basically, I guess we should tell the story. So you want to...
Sure, yeah. So the premise of the novel, this guy, Robert Kincaid, who, on a bizarre side note, his name is Robert Kincaid, and his skill, he's a photographer, and he photographs light. Just like that Thomas Kincaid who painted light. So I guess that's some sort of strange cosmic coincidence, because I don't think Thomas Kincaid was popular until after this came out, but... That's sort of odd for you. A little trivia.
Where's the centerpiece of an erotic fantasy?
Yeah.
Then it gets really hot when Thomas Kincaid comes in.
So Robert Kincaid, he's a photographer for National Geographic, former World War II photographer. This takes place in the like early 60s.
Yeah.
He's in his 50s. He is driving through Madison County, Iowa, because he is doing a pictorial on the covered bridges of Madison County. And he finds six of them, can't find the seventh, stops at a farmhouse to ask directions, and meets Francesca Johnson, who is a... You have to say her name like that. It's a spicy meatball. She is from Italy, and her husband was in the Army or Navy or something. And,
right.
sort of took her away from Italy to the happening center of the universe, Madison County, Iowa. Got a couple kids. She's in her mid-40s. The husband and the children are very conveniently at the state fair or something. And old Kincaid, old Francesca, she gives them directions to the covered bridge, if you know what I mean. And she literally gives them directions to the covered bridge, yeah. Hangs out with them for a while. Then, after a little while getting to know each other, she really gives them directions to the covered bridge. So yeah, they have a torrid affair, and eventually decide that it cannot go on, and then crazy stuff happens. We can start from the beginning, I guess, with that.
Yeah.
Would you like to jump in, Greg?
Well, I guess that one of the main sort of axes upon which this book turns is Robert James Waller's various, well, not to repeat the word axe, but axes to grind. He has a lot of things that he hates. In particular, this Robert Kincaid, the photographer's assault on Francesca's marriage, in some ways, Robert James Waller frames it as kind of like a political or moral act. That, like, this guy should be having sex with this benign farmer's wife just to stick it to mainstream society. And, like, there's all this stuff about how, you know, mainstream society and mainstream men don't really understand anything. It's kind of like bad D.H. Lawrence. Actually, I marked one page, one passage. All right, so he's going on about like how men and women are changing. Women were starting to have expectations, this is the quote, about their allotted place in the grander scheme of things, as well as what transpired in the bedrooms of their lives. Not just the literal bedrooms, but the figurative ones, too. Men such as Richard, that'd be her husband, most men, she guessed, were threatened by these expectations. In a way, women were asking for men to be poets and driving passionate lovers at the same time. Women saw no contradiction in that. Men did. The locker rooms and stag parties and pool halls and segregated gatherings of their lives defined a certain set of male characteristics in which poetry or anything of subtlety had no place. So it's just a lot of like that, like kind of buttonholing the straw man square. I thought it was a lot of sort of cheap philosophy sort of hurled at the reader.
Yeah. Yeah, and well, the characters in this book as well, they have a lot to say about philosophy.
Yeah.
And they say all of it in a way that no human being actually talks.
Yeah.
It hits you pretty early on. I'll read one of... This is from page 7. So, say about old Robert Kincaid. Yeah, he has, you know, various romances in his time, and he sees this one woman. This is long before he meets Francesca. He sees this one woman who, you know, works at the same wherever he takes his photographs. I can't remember. Anyway, they occasionally meet up and have dinner and have sex. And
yeah.
So, you know, sometimes after an intimate moment, two people, you know, talk to each other, and, you know,
sometimes
other times you just turn away or, you know, try to stop crying. It varies, you know. But after the act of intimacy, this young lady says to Robert, quote, "Robert, there's a creature inside of you that I'm not good enough to bring out, not strong enough to reach. I sometimes have the feeling you've been here a long time, more than one lifetime, and that you've dwelt in private places none of the rest of us has even dreamed about.
Yeah.
You frighten me, even though you're gentle with me. If I didn't fight to control myself with you, I feel like I might lose my center and never get back." Well, that's a heavy thing to lay on somebody in the afterglow, you know. And everybody in the book talks like this.
Yeah, well, that was what I was going to say. I mean, like Francesca later on, she says almost exactly the same thing. She says that part of the reason why she can't go with Robert is because she would be suffocated by him. That, like, his love is just so overwhelming and so overpowering and animalistic yet sensual that she would be destroyed. mm-hmm. in some very real way.
Yeah. Well, throughout the book, you know, and when Robert and Francesca finally do consummate their relationship, it gets so over the top.
Yeah.
With the praise, like the
yeah.
this you know, weird spiritual praise that's heaped on Robert Kincaid, to the point where it's like, well, you know, apparently he's just an abhuman sexual warlock who goes from town to town, you know.
Well, yeah, she says that like he has sex with her for hours,
yeah,
and then like he'll just roll over and start smoking, like yeah. just stops, just rolls
not
over.
Smoking a cigarette. He's just... So friction, you know,
and then all of a sudden he starts doing it again. Well, I don't know if you wanted to talk about this, but I'm sure we both have thoughts. But I really like the exchange between the two of them in the midst of coitus. So she says, in the middle of having sex, like they are currently having sex, she looks up at him or behind at him, I don't know, and goes, "Robert, you're so powerful. It's frightening." And he responds with, "I am the highway and a peregrine and all the sails that ever went to sea." Well, all right. You know what I mean?
What I mean is, you're hurting me. Stop that.
I don't understand that. Like, what is that supposed to mean? I don't get it.
Yeah, listen. This whole book is, you know, it's just the constant experience of, oh, well, I wouldn't have thought that worked. Maybe I'll try that. Just, you know, what's wrong with you? Well, baby, I am the Kelvinator. I am the matchbook. I'm the dream you had when you ate a hoagie. You know?
You can call me Dr. Cement Mixer. No, I mean, none of it adds up. Like, I mean, I don't buy that anybody would be, and you know, if this person really were this way, like if he did, you know, the D.H. Lawrence thing of thinking with his body and all that stuff, I don't think that he would take to the rostrum in the midst of love and announce that he is a peregrine.
No.
I just find that hard to believe.
Yeah, none of the characters are remotely believable, not only in what they say, which is, you know, just never resembles anything that a human being would actually say. I just have to stress that again.
Yeah.
But also in their actions. I mean, I was sort of curious how Waller was going to take, because I knew what was going to happen as soon as, you know, Kincaid shows up at the farmhouse.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, how is he going to, I mean, how long is he going to be in town to chip away at her until they finally have sex?
Right.
You know, because this seems like a pretty sort of high wire act. And, she basically just starts hanging out with him, and she's just crazy about him from square one. And every time she does something, like, you know, well, normally I never would have been able to imagine myself, you know, just hopping into a truck with a mysterious stranger from parts unknown and thinking about how much I want to have sex with him. But that's just what Robert Kincaid was like. Well, that doesn't explain it, you know. I mean, I haven't met him. It sounds amazing. But, you know... It's like the Bill Brasky routine from Saturday
much.
Night Live, just, you know.
Well, it's really, really weird because it generates a lot of very abstract pseudo poetry, and none of it really adds up. You know, he's always going on and on about how he's one of the last cowboys, whatever that might mean. And at one point, and this is, the novel is written in sort of a free and direct prose, so occasionally it takes on the voice or thoughts of a character, but it is at once omniscient. So at one point, the author, which I guess stands in for Francesca and Robert Kincaid, announces, "The generations must roll, and the ways whisper only of that single requirement, nothing more. The power is infinite, the design supremely elegant. The ways are unswerving. Their goal is clear. The ways are simple. We have made them seem complicated." That's like the narration for a car commercial. I mean, that could be like a new BMW. And yet it's meant to be like, ooh, well, that really gets me going. And it never really, it never is specific enough to make it vibrant. And it's never coherent enough or really even strange enough to make it interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, Kincaid goes on at great length about his elaborate philosophies, and you never understand what he's talking about, you know, what he actually stands for, stands against, just, you know, the peregrine and the cowboy and the, you know, the mashed potato and all the rest, you know. And, I mean, the whole time you're... When I was reading the book, it reminded me of, like, up until the point where they decide to part and he leaves... It feels like the first two-thirds of a Flannery O'Connor short story. Mm. Like, it's going to take some, you know, he's just this huckster who's going to lure her away, and then Robert Blind, and the book will end with her sitting in a Dairy Queen in Tupelo or something, just, you know, wishing she still had her car. Yeah, I mean, because it seems false. I mean, everything he says seems like he's just bullshitting her. And, you know, you wonder if... Yeah, I mean, if I'd written the book, the twist ending would be that as soon as he leaves, he goes to the next town and does the whole thing again with some other board housewife, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that was the thing that always rang false to me about his big critiques of modern society. You know, like, apparently when he's a little boy, when he's child prodigy, Robert Kincaid, he announces to his teachers that IQ scores are insufficient because they fail to account for magic. And isn't magic really what we're trying to measure with a standardized test? Yeah. No. There's just stuff like that all over the book. Like, the book very weightily announces, through Robert Kincaid, analysis destroys holes. W holes. Some things, magic things, are meant to stay whole. If you look at their pieces, they go away. Now, that's all good and well, but... The whole premise of the book is that these people had like a tiny fragment of a relationship. And the only way that they remember it is through further fragments. Like, she remembers him through like images that she sees in National Geographic. He remembers her through a tiny little note that she tacked to a bridge, destroying a precious national landmark. Yeah. And, you know, it just doesn't make any sense that on the one hand he's asserting, you know, oh, wholeness and nature and love... And then, you know, but oh, some things are fragmentary and weird, and you have to only remember them when you're alone and sad. And, you know, like the whole vegetarian thing, and he goes on and on about how great it is to be a photographer and stuff. It's like, well, you know, photography is to painting as a tractor is to cowboy. So, yeah. I mean, like, why are cowboys awesome and painters suck? You know, like, what's the deal?
Yeah. Well, probably because Robert James Waller is a photographer. Yeah. And also Robert Kincaid, you know. Yeah. I mean, it sort of has the... I mean, just tonight, you know, I asked you, Greg...
You had a third Greg.
I asked other Greg. I said, other Greg, have you ever seen a picture of Robert James Waller? And we both realized we never had.
Yeah.
And so I pulled out my smartphone, and I looked it up.
Yeah.
And it's Robert Kincaid. I mean, that's what he looks like. He's even wearing the same suspenders he describes in the book at great length. Apparently, orange suspenders are, in the mind of Waller, you know, the mark of a striking man. It's this bizarre fantasy self he has created that almost reads like fan fiction, except fan fiction for a cheap romance novel, I suppose. But it, I mean, it has pretensions of being something much greater.
Yeah.
And I guess in 1991-92 it was. I mean, it sold 50 million copies. I mean, it was just enormous. I'm not entirely sure why, but I guess it. I guess sort of for similar reasons to the success of. 50 Shades of Grey or something. Mm. That's a genre novel that has trappings of being something more.
Yeah.
Whether it actually isn't important.
Right. Well, I mean, it's benign enough in a lot of ways. Like, there's not really explicit sex. Even, you know, the conventional marriage is restored and validated at the end. Like, at the end of it all, the lovebirds, the people who are completely consumed with desire and passion for each other, they break up. Mm. And they're glad they did. Yeah. Which makes no sense.
No.
And she says this big thing about, you're like, oh, well, you're just a wild peregrine, and, you know, you're the sump pump of my heart, and all this stuff. Yeah. And that somehow rationalizes not going away with him, or not, you know, staying there with him, or whatever. Mm. But, I mean, I do think it's instructive to think about, like, you know, because every author has to use their own life's material. And you can only write about things that in some way you've known. Flannery O'Connor said that, like, any adult or any person who had lived to the age of 12 had enough, you know, experience to write a novel. And that's true. But it relies on the idea that, like, you do need to accumulate some experience. But Robert James Waller kind of just is writing fan fiction about his own life. Like, you know, as I said to you earlier today, like, it's basically like he was driving around in his car and was like, hey, you know, it'll be hot. As if I stopped for directions, and this dame was, like, Italian and a vegetarian too. Like, we just had sex for a week. Yeah, and I mean, that's it. You know, every author, no matter what author you pick, I mean, it can be the most rarefied and you know, genius-level author you want to talk about. They include things about themselves, and sometimes they purposefully include peaks of their own lives. But the idea that it's some sort of vanity or flashing the audience, like the fiction is sort of your overcoat, and then periodically you show your privates to them. That thing really bothered me about this book.
Yeah. Well, I think we should also talk about the husband, Richard.
Mm. Mm.
I think that a lot of our names is yeah. very confusing, but I think Richard.
Richard Johnson.
Yeah.
Dick Johnson.
Yeah. old Dick. So this is the guy, Francesca's husband, who's at the state fair. And it's an impressive feat that throughout the entire book, not a single positive thing is said about him. And, you know, it would be... I mean, at least, yeah, one thing I'll say in the notebook's favor is that, at least with the notebook, the cuckold, whatever his name was, I mean, he at least came across as sort of, yeah, he wasn't a malicious guy, he wasn't a bad guy, you felt kind of bad for him, probably to a greater degree than Sparks intended. But with this, it's just set up so that Richard Johnson is just a horse's ass. He's just, you know, I mean, he has... nothing resembling, I mean, not culture, just interest in the world around him. You know, I liked that there's a part where, you know, he loves to watch that TV, flip on the old idiot box. And the only time he ever calls Francesca in, because she doesn't like TV, because, you know, she's the Fortunato of the Montresor and the Peregrine's something.
She's European, man. Come on.
She's a real medicine hat. And, the only time she watches TV is when Richard calls her in to see something that's just awful on the television. Yeah. Like those Beatles with their woman hair, or that Elvis. It's like, you know, it's one of these things, because, I mean, the book was written in 89, it's set in 63. It's basically just, you know, Waller saying, see, look at these things he hated. Don't you like the Beatles? Don't you like Elvis? Yeah. Wasn't he a jackass?
Yeah.
And he's, you know, he's... So far removed from any understanding of his wife's feelings that after she's just had this torrid affair and is emotionally damaged, she's like, oh, what's the matter with you? You stub your toe or something? Well, anyway, dang.
Yeah, exactly.
He just hate him. I mean, which makes it all the dumber when Francesca and Kincaid eventually decide, like, well, we can't possibly do this thing that would make us both happy. That's...
Right.
And allegedly they do it... I guess the biggest reason is because of her children.
Hmm.
But then at the end of the book, the children find this manuscript she's written about the affair, and they find all of Kincaid's personal effects in her possession, and they find out the whole story. And they're just mortified that their mother gave up her entire life to live a sham, you know?
Yeah.
So it benefited no one.
Well, it's especially frustrating... because I always hate it whenever authors of a historical situation or you're referring to something that is long in the past kind of pat the audience on the back for, like, oh man, you're not a square like him. You didn't fall for that trap. Mm-hmm. Because the fact of the matter is that if you'd gone up to,
Waller?
Waller. If you gone up to Waller in the late 80s and been like, hey, man, you know what you ought to do? Is there's this dead Kennedys and Jello Biafra and all this stuff, and, you know, like a bunch, and that's not even particularly hip for the late 80s, but like weird stuff.
Yeah,
they'd be like, ew, gross. This isn't, you know, the Wind Whistlers music. He'd be all mad, and yet this guy who Francesca inexplicably marries, and why she would ever marry this guy to begin with, but he's made to be basically like one of the rednecks that they encounter at the end of Easy Rider. He's just a cartoon caricature of the worst aspects of American masculinity.
Yeah.
He never surprises you. He never makes anything different. I guess there's one time at the end of the book where he says, like, well, Francesca, I guess you had dreams too.
Yeah. On his deathbed. Yeah. Well, sorry, I kind of squandered both our lives.
Did either of us have fun? It's hard to say, isn't it?
With the benefit of hindsight, I can sort of see how maybe I'm a piece of shit. But
Well, that was the thing that really bothered me about all these characters was that they just kind of dropped out of the sky. Mm-hmm. Fully formed. None of them had really collided with the world in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, you know, Richard, her husband, is just like a pile of congealed arteries and resentment. And Robert Kincaid is, you know, a traveling prophet, and who knows why. And he's just always been like this. He's one of the foretold. And then there's Francesca. And, you know, if you plop an Italian war bride down in the middle of Iowa, you'd think that'd be an interesting character. But she's completely vanilla. She's completely indistinguishable from anybody else. And all the, like, vague hints about, you know, oh, once she had an affair with a young man named Niccolo in Naples. Like, all right. And? You know, does she miss her family? Does she speak Italian still? Nothing. Nothing at all.
Yeah, well, and there's some reference to, you know, she marries Richard, she says, because, you know, he offered kindness and a ticket to America, you know. And she talks about how, you know, she doesn't regret moving to Iowa. And then you read the book, and you're like, well, why the hell not? Yeah. I mean, why would she not want to be back in Italy? Or anywhere other than where.
Yeah, because when Robert asks her what her life is like, and he's like, oh, so what's it like living in this town? And she has this, you know, weighty pause where she thinks about what she's supposed to say, which is, you know, it's a great place to raise kids. And then she realizes, no, it's not. It's fucking awful. People are always gossiping and being mean and saying stuff, and they're ignorant and they're small-minded. It's like, well, why wouldn't she? Where is the not regret again?
Yeah.
Where is she happy and thankful? I tend to think that if somebody said, you know, like, well, basically I'm marrying this guy because he's a nice ticket across the Atlantic Ocean, then probably you're canny and roll with the punches enough that you don't stay with that guy necessarily. Yeah. I don't know. I've never done that. Mm-hmm. But I would tend to think so.
Well, when I left the old country, I was going to go back to Hungary one day. Anyway, yeah, her story doesn't make any sense. Her characterization doesn't make any sense. And I mean, the town, you know, as badly as the husband comes across, the town maybe comes off even worse.
Mm.
You know, and their interactions with Kincaid. Basically, when Kincaid enters the room, everybody just gets together and like, oh, who's that hippie? What about?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just awful stuff. Just everybody is suspicious of him instantly and
right.
Just hates him. And, you know, there's no... I mean, admittedly, you know, this is the rural area in the 60s. I get that. But you never see the good side.
Yeah.
You never see a single positive.
Right.
The only thing I'll say that I think this book does do pretty well is I think that some of the setting, with the exception of the people, I think the setting is pretty good.
Hmm.
Or at least a vast improvement over the setting of The Notebook, where you couldn't tell where the hell you were.
An amorphous cloud.
Yeah. Yeah, you get a pretty good sense of place. And yeah. I kind of liked the Kincaid's descriptions of, like, you know, how he was taking the pictures. which seemed to have... There seemed to be some substance to that, probably because it was based on Waller's actual experiences taking pictures and getting the picture at the right time.
Right.
But, you know, that was like three pages of 170.
Something. Yeah, well, and that was the odd thing, is that there's a lot of stuff in this book about, you know, oh, views into a life you didn't have, and, you know, alternate realities, and, you know, oh, if only I, the road not taken, you know, that old chestnut. That old Robert Johnson song or whatever who did that. Instead, you know, like, he doesn't make any mileage really out of the fact that Robert Kincaid is photographing bridges. There's just nothing about the metaphorical weight of bridges or anything like that. It's just, you know, oh, they're pretty cool looking, aren't they?
Yeah.
You know?
they're covered. yeah. For some reason.
And there's just, like, a lot of missed opportunities like that. And actually, that may well be one of the more tragic parts of Robert James Waller, just as an individual. I mean, I'm sure he's pretty happy being, you know, a multimillionaire. But wherever you are, Robert James Waller, in your citadel of pleasure, it just occurs to me that he's yet another person who doesn't know the most interesting part of his own life. The most interesting part of his own life is his craft, like his ability to scout locations, why he chooses one location as opposed to another, what he values about places that he does choose, you know, that kind of thing. Even like how he deals with light. I mean, that was pretty interesting. But instead, he wants to be known as like William Butler Yeats Redivivus. I mean, it's just like, well, why? Why does this have to happen?
Speaking of light, can I make an extremely picky and petty complaint about this book?
Yeah.
And this is, you know, this is sort of in the territory of me complaining about a lack of detailed car descriptions in a novel. It's a nerd thing, but it surprised me that this actually made the cut. This is from Robert's letter to Francesca. God or the universe or whatever one chooses to label the great systems of balance and order does not recognize Earth time. To the universe, 4 days is no different than 4 billion light years. I try to keep that in mind. Guess what else you should keep in mind, Kincaid? A light year is a measure of distance. Just angered me, I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, the idea that, like, oh, to the universe it isn't different. It's like, well, actually it is pretty different.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the thing that people always ignore about, like, you know, like, oh, well, ever since the theory of relativity, it's all relative, man, is that it's all relative when you're traveling at the speed of light.
Yeah.
Any other time, you're still a human being. I always hate it when people try and, you know, like, well, I straddle the cosmos with my mighty man legs. Like, no, you don't.
No.
Nobody does.
Everything Kincaid says reminds me of being in college and having somebody come up and say,
yeah,
hey, man, I want you to read this thing I wrote while I was really high last night.
Yeah.
I think it's going to open. No, it won't. It won't open. It's going to be just, you know, what if, like, we're just an atom in the universe that's part of a toe of some sort of crazy-looking dog? You know, who the fuck cares? What does that even mean? What's, you know...
Well, it's always important the dog's kind of weird, you know?
Yeah.
Not AKC kind of yeah, dog.
Well, you know, how the dog looks, man, is just relative to the universe. Could be weird-looking, could be a regular Marmaduke. I don't know.
A regular Marmaduke is always how I praise my women. But yeah, we should maybe talk about the parts that I think Robert James Waller wants us to admire him for.
Okay.
Which is his... I think that he sort of wants us to puzzle over these things. Like, man, what, whoa, where'd that come from? I think that when he wrote this book, he thought people would devote years of exegesis to it. For exactly the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, and this actually structurally was a weird moment, like in terms of someone who's, you know, sat down, tried to write a realistic scene, or even a convincing scene, this was a weird scene. So Francesca is sitting there watching Robert watch her, and she imagines that Robert is imagining a poem about her. And so she imagines Robert's imaginary poem as follows. The bottle unopened, and glasses empty. She reached to find them somewhere north of Middle River in Iowa. I watched her with eyes that had seen a Hivaro's Amazon and the Silk Road with caravan dust climbing behind me, reaching into unused spaces of Asian sky. What the hell's that? I mean, like, it's so... It reminded me of the most annoying types of poetry, which is just basically poorly spaced prose. And what it all is supposed to mean about the two of them, like, nothing that they think or say ever indicates something about the relationship. It all makes you think, man, this author is really poetic. That's all the ultimate point of any description or any invention on Waller's part, is just, look at me.
Yeah. Well, and he has, yeah, I don't have it in front of me, but he has the quote, you know, mentioned earlier, that he says something about, you know, the, and the high desert priest said, never again, never again, which I think is something that, that Kincaid just says while they're in a restaurant or something. And so I just read that and thought, well, that must be a quote from a poem I haven't heard. So I Googled it, and all that came up was the bridges of Madison County. It's like, well, if that doesn't come from anything, I mean, I kind of like the turn of phrase, but I mean, it doesn't mean anything. It's just, you know.
Well, like while they're having sex, the night went on and the great spiral dance continued. Robert Kincaid discarded all sense of anything linear and moved to a part of himself that dealt only with shape and sound and shadow. And then, so he starts talking to her during sex, and he heard the words he whispered to her. So it's almost as though the characters, even Robert James Waller knows the characters aren't real. Like, they hear themselves saying this shit, and they're like, what? I didn't say that.
Well, that's a pan-dimensional fuck wizard is just, you know, when Robert Kincaid has sex with you, you know, it's in your past, your future, alternate realities, your soul has an orgasm.
Well, he says that. There's mental orgasms. He says, yeah, there's physical ones and there's spiritual ones. So while they're having sex, another voice takes over his own, and he speaks as the shaman, and he says, fragments of a Rilke poem, around the ancient tower I have been circling for 1,000 years, the lines to a Navajo sun chant, he whispered to her of the visions she brought to him, of blowing sand and magenta winds and brown pelicans riding the backs of dolphins moving north along the coast of Africa.
Well, you know, with all that stuff about circling the ancient tower for far too long, maybe I was trying to send her a little message. You know? Look, baby, the brown pelican can't wait forever, all right? It's about a little give and take here.
Dolphins rounding the Horn of Africa! Yeah, what I just don't understand that. I mean, it is, you know, I've heard a ton of times readers say, like, oh, well, you know, in Ulysses, James Joyce is just trying to make you remember how cool James Joyce is. It's like, no, this is an example. This is a time when the only reason it's on the page is so you'll be impressed with how cool Robert James Waller is. Wow. Which brings us to Falling from Dimension Z.
I'm going to let you handle this one, man, because I don't even know where to begin with this shit.
Well, there's... So inevitably, Robert Kincaid dies, as we all must. Even Robert Kincaid. Yeah.
Well, he mysteriously reformed on a different continent, I'm sure.
He, like, leaves his remains, like his, you know, professional remains, to Francesca. He sends her his cameras, and he sends her a manuscript called Falling from Dimension Z. And it's just all this odd stuff. Like, he claims to be in Arizona, and then he regresses into evolution, and he's in the Ice Age. And then he's a plankton. And then he's the digit zero. And it concludes with... and there's a lot of things like a kind of soft enlacing. Not prim intersections loomed in a world of precision. No sound of the shuttle. Just, well, breathing. All right. And then...
Yeah, I dig it. Okay.
Then it climaxes with, somewhere, inside of the breathing, music sounds. And the curious spiral dance begins then, with a meter all its own that tempers the Iceman with spear and matted hair. And slowly, rolling and turning in adagio... In Adagio always, Iceman falls from Dimension Z. and into her. I mean, it's so bewildering. I mean, it's not bewildering in a cool way either.
It's the old evolutionary meat cute, you know. Well, the old Iceman just fell right into
her. Well, it's kind of like that Phil Hartman thing, you know, caveman lawyer. You know? But it does bring us back to one of the more unusual comments that is repeated. So in the 20th century, one of the frequent tropes, or actually even back into the 18th and 19th century, is this, you know, like the noble savage, you know, like, oh man, like, oh, I come from another place and I'm quite primitive by your modern standards, but in fact, down deep, I'm good. And I don't know why all those weird voices are necessary. But anyway, in this book, it isn't just that he's primitive. It's that, as you said, he's like abhuman. Like he belongs to a different thread of evolution than everyone else. And I don't really know what that is, except for Robert James Waller just doesn't know when hyperbole ends. You know, like when you maybe need to stop and pull in the reins a little bit.
Yeah, it's one thing to say he's from a different time. Say, like, well, he's basically a Neanderthal. He's, he doesn't understand how cups work. He hates pants. He finds them constricting. Yeah, it's sort of strange. My favorite description of Kincaid, though, on page 151 of my copy. Let me find this. Now, this is from Francesca leaves, with all of Kincaid's personal effects, she leaves this letter for her children to find after her death. But she dies, by the way. She's, you know, sort of strange, Waller points out, that no one knew quite why she died. Just slumped over at the kitchen table. Perhaps of a broken heart? Who's to say? But she leaves this letter behind to kind of tell the kids, you know, hey, you're probably wondering what's up with these cameras. Well, let me tell you the story about the affair I had. And she describes... I forgot to mark which paragraph it was. All right. In a way, he was not of this earth. That's about as clear as I can say it. I've always thought of him as a leopard-like creature who rode in on the tail of a comet. You know, if I were reading that, I'd think, well, I know what killed Ma. The gas leak in the house. A leopard-like creature who rode in on the tail of a comet. Which, I mean, yeah, oh, yeah, that sounds erotic. That's a real... No wonder she fell for him.
Catman the Comet Boy.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we should conclude by, of course, talking about the magical black man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, actually, magical is probably stretching it. He's not particularly magical, but...
He is oracular.
He is. So, and we've talked about this in the past, again, with The Notebook, which stole everything from this book.
Everything.
I kind of wish we'd read this one first and then The Notebook. But so, at the end of it, you know, you... Waller, at first you think, is just going to leave us with the knowledge that, well, Kincaid just died mysteriously, and no one knows. Which probably would have been a good choice, stylistically.
Yeah.
And then, I guess the publisher put a gun to his head and said, you know, all right, we need another chapter, Waller. Okay, well, you've got 10 minutes. All right, crank it out. And so he writes this thing about, this is supposedly a transcribed interview that Waller conducted with, old black jazz man lived up at Puget Sound, and
that's where you find him.
Yeah, so really the hotbed of jazz, especially in 1989. So this guy apparently knew Kincaid, and at first you think it's going to be the sort of thing like, "Oh yeah, well I saw him once, and he said one word, and you know that stuff." No, he was like really good friends with him and talked to him all the time. You know, they were basically best buds. And, you know, Kincaid took pictures of this jazz guy, and he, you know, the jazz guy wrote a song for Kincaid called Francesca. And it's just, I mean, again, we're repeating ourselves, or I'm repeating myself here, but exactly like The Notebook,
yeah.
The way you tell that he's the wise old black guy is he doesn't use a G on the end of a single one of his verbs. He's just too busy talking to use a G. And it's, I don't know what it was about, like, the 90s, but you seem to see this a lot in the, you know, 80s and 90s, this the old black guy who has no desires or dreams of his own shows up to show a few white people a thing or two about a thing. But anyway, he basically reveals that, you know, Kincaid died sad and alone, which we already knew. It doesn't really add too much depth to it. But it just struck me as a terrible ending.
Well, actually, I should not let go of this chance, as we have done with many other books, to morally indict our authors and say they're not just unskilled, but they're awful.
For shame, Robert James Waller.
All right, I will argue that there is a long literary tradition of speaking through a persona of being one of the downtrodden. So, you know, Joel Chandler Harris, Uncle Remus, you know, Aesop's Fables, probably not actually written by a slave named Aesop. You know, Homer in Greek means captive. Probably he was not just a slave, et cetera, et cetera. There's better examples I could think of if I actually have thought of this before now.
The Three Stooges, Heathcliff, you know, the cartoon.
And in this book, there is meant to be a lot of sniping at mainstream white comfortable society. And the way that he does that is by giving voice to a hippie, basically, who strangely, despite being in the war, has no memory of the war, doesn't really talk about the war or anything. A foreign woman who is supposed to reflect like all these things about women that men just don't get, like the secret lives of women. And then finally, a marginalized black guy. But out of that trio, the only one who lives his dream, the white guy. the lady just sits at home and takes care of people who fill her with resentment because she's not with, you know, her man friend. And she can only sort of grudgingly at the end of her life go like, well, it wasn't all bad. And then this jazz man is kind of like, yeah, it didn't really make any sense, and now I live in this weird apartment. And yeah, I guess that internationally famous photographer probably could have helped me out a little bit. I mean, I think that it's sort of cheap to use it to take pot shots at other white people that you don't like without actually, like, making the characters vibrant or individual.
Yeah. I'd agree with that.
So screw you, Robert James Waller. Had to get it in there.
Cry yourself to sleep on your pile of money tonight, you jerk. Well, would you recommend this book, Greg?
No. Surprisingly, I would not. You know, I thought about recommending a different book. A different book along the same lines. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a long time I thought that this kind of book was sort of modeled on the Odyssey. You know, sort of like a wandering man who returns to this woman. And I think now, it plays on a fantasy of living out in the woods and, you know, mysteriously this woman shows up and loves you and wants to have sex with you. It's sort of like The Tempest or Walden plus porn. So in that vein, I will recommend Friedrich Nietzsche's The Antichrist. Because if you want to read a crazed egomaniac's self-important rantings, just go straight to the source. Just go to latter-day Nietzsche when he thought that he was Jesus and the emperor and a dog's ass. And just read that. That's my recommendation. Friedrich Nietzsche, Antichrist.
I am the peregrine. I am the Jesus. I am the dog's ass. Yeah, that's a good recommendation. I would... The only circumstances under which I would recommend this book are if you were dead set on reading like a Harlequin romance novel or something, I'd say this is the better alternative to that. Yeah, faint praise. generally, I would not recommend it on the whole. What I would recommend instead, I'm not trying to start a trend here of my recommendations all being extremely similar, but I would recommend The Life You Save May Be Your Own by Flannery O'Connor. Which is basically the story I wish this had been. Read it and you'll find out. But yeah, that's all I've got.
I think the way that, you know, they do all those Jane Austen books plus monsters, you start doing romance novels plus Flannery O'Connor.
So, I guess our next book.
Yeah.
Is a mystery. We're going to decide in chambers what our next book is.
Well, you know, part of it is we're building up anticipation because despite the fact that 4 days and 4 light years are all the same to the universe, we are in fact chomping down on our 1 year anniversary as canon fodderists.
It's true.
Canon fodderists. So we need to come up with a very special canon fodder event in the coming months. And, you know, we want to kind of keep you on your toes, kind of keep you guessing, which doesn't mean you shouldn't stop emailing us.
No. Keep it up, in fact.
Yeah. Double negatives kind of confused me there for a minute.
The important message is never speak to us again. Wait, no. Yes, please email us, canonfodderpod@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can follow me on Twitter, @BenRWilliams. You can occasionally follow Greg on... Have you posted on Twitter in, like, the last...
6 months.
6 months. No. Never mind that. You can go to my website, BenRWilliams.com. Mm-hmm. And you should also go to SewnTogetherRecords.com.
Yes.
You should download some music. You should check out the You Are Here release, which is both a digital and physical release. It has some great stuff on it from all your favorite Roanoke bands. The Peregrines on there, the Frigidaire, Uncle Munster, you know, all of them. You should also download some Ryan Browning music. Ryan Browning, of course, provides the bookends to Cannon Fodder. So download his song Destroyer.
Yeah.
And so without any further ado, I guess, good night from the farmhouse.
Good night, everybody.